I'd like to call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order. It is now 1:02 p.m. on Tuesday, February 3rd.
Groundhog Day yesterday.
February 3rd, 2026, in Barnes Room 120. I should just stick to the script. Members present include Representative St. Clair, Representative Nelson, Representative Stutes, Representative McCabe, Representative Mina, Co-Chair Eichheid, and myself, Representative Carrick. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones today. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records and Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for staffing our committee today. Our committee aide today is my staff, Griffin Sukeo, and Meredith Trainer from my co-chair's office. Thank you both for your help. On today's agenda, we are bringing House Bill 216 back before the committee from Representative Holland's office. This is the transfer of railroad land to Whittier. Following that, we will continue our presentation from last Thursday on winter road maintenance. And we will end our meeting today with a presentation from DOT on defining advanced construction and federal aid sources. So taking a closer look at that. So with that, we are going to have House Bill 216 back before us. I'd like to invite the bill sponsor staff to just very briefly reintroduce yourself and the bill before we open public testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. My name is Aiden Nichols, staff to Representative Holland. And the bill, HB 216, gives the limited and specific authorization for the Alaska Railroad Corporation to transfer 5 parcels of land to the city of Whittier.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Nichols, for that quick introduction. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Nelson.
I apologize. Well, I'll just ask the question, and then if we need to move on. The question that I had was, I know we were tight on time last week. I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Decorum. Yeah, I apologize. I'm learning. Through the chair. It was mentioned last week, I believe, that 40% of Whittier's budget was or has been spent or is annually spent on these leases, correct?
That is my understanding, Representative, through the chair.
Do you know how long that's been going on and what the total dollar amount is?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, we actually have in the room Jackie Wild, who's the city manager. If it's all right with the co-chair, I would like to invite her up. I believe she will be better equipped to answer that question than I will.
Welcome, Ms. Jackie Wild. Thank you for being here. And I would have mentioned you earlier. I didn't know you were here, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Nielsen. Hi, I'm Jackie Wild with the City of Whittier. To answer the question, it is not 40% of the budget. It is 40% of the gross revenues on master lease lands, and that has been in effect since 1998.
Follow-up. So since 1998... how much has the city of Whittier spent on these particular leases?
An estimated of just over $2 million.
Over $2 million. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I do also just want to note we do have online Megan Clemens, our external affairs manager with the Alaska Railroad, and the vice president of real estate for the Railroad Corporation, Christy Terry, also online for questions. Do we have additional questions for any of our folks? Seeing none, we are going to go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 216. I see no one online to testify. Is there anyone in the room who would like to offer public testimony on House Bill 216? Seeing none, we are going to go ahead and close public testimony at this time. And we have House Bill 216 back before us. Offer a final opportunity for folks to ask any questions. I'd also just like to note we did set an amendment deadline for House Bill 216 and did not receive amendments to the co-chair's offices. Seeing no additional questions, I would look to Co-Chair Eichscheid for a motion.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I move that House Bill 216, Work Order 34-LS0946/A-alpha, move from the Transportation Committee with individual recommendations and attach FISCO notes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 216 has been moved from committee. We're going to take an at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease. House Transportation Committee is back on the record. Thank you to our DOT folks for hanging out for that bill presentation. So next we are going to go back to our winter maintenance and operations presentation from last week. We had finished at slide 19, but I'm actually going to ask us to go back to slide 18, which is titled Central Region Challenges and Opportunities. Before we begin, I just want to note we have a lot of folks from DOT who are available for questions today. We obviously have Andy Mills, from our commissioner's office, and our handy-dandy Dom Pannone, also from DOT, here in the room. Online, we have Kristen Langley, Division Director at DOT, Jason Sakalaskas, also from Northern Region DOT, Brad Bilesma, our State Equipment Fleet Manager at DOT, Marcus Zimmerman from Maintenance and Operations, and Burl Nickerson, who's our Maintenance and Operations Manager, who I believe is probably going to be first up here in answering some questions. But I'd like to invite Mr. Mills and Pannone up to the dais.
Speak me for now.
And?
Madam Co-Chair, if you'd like Dom at the table, of course he'll come. But I believe I'll lead this part and he'll do the next presentation.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, for the record, Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. An initial congratulations. Both of you did an excellent job with some of the most complicated last names, so thank you. You are correct. We do have, a good group of folks for any questions that the committee may have statewide. So knowing that there's a question, I may pause and let that question be prompted. And as you correctly put, Mr. Nickerson online is the appropriate person to give the initial answer.
So I'm going to turn right to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Appreciate the presentation that we had earlier, and we were running up on time about brine versus salt. Very informative, and it focused a lot on the Kenai and some of the measures you guys are taking down there. But I had a specific question about the Glen Highway and the Moose Creek Bridge. And so I know that there's multiple challenges with that particular chunk of road and beyond. But the steep grade, the narrow bridge corners, and also this winter with basically the water coming out of the side of the hill, the spring that was overflowing and freezing on the road, and I saw DOT crews out there a lot. So my question was, do you know at this point how many hours your guys have been out there or how many total times they've been out there with either steam trucks or graders? Or I know that it's a really broad question, but it's a narrow part of the road, which is one of the major thoroughfares through our state. And so just would like to have a little bit more understanding of, I mean, I only see it when I drive by there, but just from your guys' perspective, how much time you've spent out there, if possible.
Mr. Nickerson, I believe that will be for you.
For the record, Burrell Nickerson, Central Region Maintenance and Operations Manager. Just want to make sure everybody can hear me.
We can. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, Representative Nelson, excellent question. And I actually have that information at my fingertips. If you would please allow me to elaborate on the work that's going on out there. We're talking about the north side of the Glen Highway, just east of Moose Creek Bridge, which is just north of Palmer. This is an area where we have seen over the years both subsurface water as well as surface water come down into that north ditch line, draining towards Moose Creek. this year just happens to be one of those years where it's coming out of the ground, out of the rock face and out of the ground. It's not something that maintenance and operations can control. It's a continuous problem. Again, it's we never know when it's going to happen, and then this year is just one of those years when it does. You asked specifically about the number of hours. I have this a spreadsheet where the local station there in Palmer has been tracking it. The number of hours we have so far is 231. That's as of, I believe, last week. So that's multiple. That's usually groups of two, sometimes up to five individuals that are out there trying to treat that problem. This was noticed all the way back in November, and it is ongoing. The type of work that's involved is obviously thawing that ice, trying to get as much of it as away as possible, and obviously trying to create a clear surface for a clear driving surface, which then requires graders to usually take out whatever ice is there. And then also we heavily sand that area. So it is a monitored area, keeping a watchful eye on that. And the crew out there is trying to jump on it as soon as possible. With that, does that answer your question? And I'm happy to entertain any more on that.
Follow up? Just a follow-up comment. I think you guys have done a tremendous job, and it's also a tremendously challenging area as it rolls right into that narrow bridge. And so I appreciate the context and the data that you provided, but just want to say that you guys are doing a good job in a really challenging area where it's kind of blind coming from both sides into a really narrow bridge. So thank you for your answer.
Through the co-chair, again, for the record, Grell Nickerson, Central Region Maintenance and Operations Manager. Very much appreciate the kudos on that one, Representative Nelson. It is a tough area. I will say that our design section has taken notice as well. If you're aware, we had an environmental assessment that was done, I think, back in the 90s that was going to get rid of that curve. That environmental assessment, I hope I have my knowledge correct, is now expired with FHWA. It's just too old. So I do believe that the design section is looking again at that section of the Glen Highway and trying to figure out what to do about that curb, that bridge, and, of course, the many problems in the area. But, again, thank you for the kudos. I hope you don't mind if I pass that on to the crew.
Great. I think we're good to continue the presentation now.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Andy Mills. We're advancing to slide 19, which I believe starts the northern region section. And so Mr. Sakalaskis on Teams will pick this up from here for the next few slides.
All right. Thank you. For the record, Jason Sakalaskis, Northern Region Maintenance and Operations Chief. Before I continue, can everybody hear me all right?
We can. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'm presenting here today from Fairbanks and appreciate to continue our discussion on winter maintenance across the state. Before you can see, we started off here with our northern region performance measures or targets here and how we've been performing this year. So basically, this is a quick look pretty much from September to December. So this winter's operations. As you can see, list out the total number of events and our targets and the times we've achieved those targets. And I'll say right now, Northern Region's performing right now at about a 72% success rate at meeting our priority level targets. So those are the priority level targets, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and have a response time of 12, 18, 24, and 30 hours. So I wanted to pause here for a moment and go over a couple questions that were also asked during the last session to kind of cover those with regards to some of the brine discussions we had. There was primarily, I believe, three questions that were asked, so I will go ahead and cover those for Northern Region's response, and if there's any further, I'm more than happy to take those after these. The first one, I recall, was, do we use brine corrosion inhibitors? And the answer is yes, Northern Region does use corrosion inhibitors when they're using chemicals that are actually dropping the temperatures that we have an additive that reduces the temperature for application of our brine so we can apply it at a little bit colder rate. One thing to provide for context within Northern Region, we primarily only use brine in two of our districts, which is Fairbanks District and our Valdez District. And within our Fairbanks District, we primarily use it in our urban areas immediately around Fairbanks.
Mr. Sakalaskas, I was trying not to interrupt your presentation on this slide, but I did have a question about private operators, say like parking lot cleaning up, and there was a letter to the editor back in January about that for Fairbanks. And is there any restriction on private folks using brine for sidewalk or parking lot clearing? And how does DOT interact with situations like that, if at all?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. So I will say, I don't know that there's any prohibitions to utilizing chemicals. I do know that there are several entities that do use multiple type of, I'll say, anti-icing or salt, I'll say, applications within the Fairbanks area. We do not specifically interact with those entities, as they're kind of a private contractors, a lot for the private entities and businesses in Fairbanks.
Okay, that's what I was guessing. I just wanted to get some clarity on that. Thank you.
All right, not a problem. I'll go ahead and continue on covering a couple of the brine questions we had from last presentation or earlier sessions. We did get asked, what is kind of the most effective, or is brine effective in our operations, and what's the cost for those? Overall, I believe we answered before. I'll go back to what Burrell said. It is a very difficult thing to perfectly quantify, but let me give some context maybe on the question. Again, primarily we utilize brine in the Fairbanks area. Right now we utilize brine only down to about 20 degrees for roadway application. So just for context, if you lived in Fairbanks right now, we have not applied the brine solution across the roadway surfaces since pretty much October, because we've been below 20 degrees Fahrenheit. With that said, though, we do actually apply brine in the form of what we call pre-wetting. And pre-wetting is applying a small amount of brine to our basically traction aids, or our sand that we apply to the roadway. This occurs during the application of the sand, and the intent of that is to prevent what we call bounce and scatter, and to lock in the aggregates into the roadway surface for a longer duration. And what studies have shown is you can reduce your sand usage up to around 50% potentially by utilizing a pre-wetting process, because as the aggregates pre-wet, it lands within the lane of travel, and it tends to burn in or freeze in place to that location. And so that reduces our material usage. It actually helps with also environmental controls, as you have less sand being applied to the roadway surface, hence into storm drains as it continues in the spring, etc. And then also it does improve the overall safety, as you do have sand present on the roadway longer within the, I'll say, the vehicle lanes or vehicle wheel wells or wheels traffic areas. So we do believe, our brine applications do are more cost effective, overall reduce environmental impacts, and then also are cost prohibitive to our actions in improving safety. So hope that kind of covered that question there, a couple of the topics discussed before. And then the last one was, do we use brine to supplement for vacancies? I will say no, that's not being done at this time, although I do say with the use of brine, it does make our operations a little more efficient, reducing sand application and allowing crews to do other actions besides just sanding of intersections and roadways, so they can fund other tasks that they also have to do as part of operations. I'll go ahead and pause there and ensure I kind of covered all three questions from last session, and see if there's any further.
Mr. Sakalaskas, I do have one other question that's unrelated to the brine, but is on this slide. And that's our sidewalk equipment. Just wanted to ask the question, do we have sufficient sidewalk equipment for the Fairbanks area and staffing to support pedestrian walkways in the winter?
Yeah, through the co-chair, Mrs. Garrett. That is a great question. I will say that was going to be the next covered in that slide, is talking about our sidewalk equipment. So perfect lead in. I'll go ahead and answer that question and kind of continue on. So I will say we've listed out our sidewalk equipment here. We have found that we wanted to improve our sidewalk maintenance or increase our sidewalk maintenance to meet some of the pedestrian requests across the Fairbanks area. And we've actually also contracted out, which I'll cover on the next slide, some of our sidewalk maintenance. And you should see that primarily here this winter. Anchorage kind of led that initiative, I'll say, I believe last year, with doing some sidewalk pedestrian contracting. We talked about those kind of operations, decided that was an efficient way for us to do that versus investing in more equipment and personnel. So we chose to issue a couple contracts here this year, some local contractors, and they're assisting us in performing pedestrian facility maintenance. So I'll go ahead and go on if that fully answered your question.
Yes, it did. Thank you.
All right, next slide, please. So I'm moving on. We wanted to speak to some of the resources that we're utilizing to improve our winter maintenance operations in Northern Region. As you can see, we kind of did a look back just for everybody's awareness of when we started utilizing winter maintenance contractors. And what we see is that primarily started in fiscal year 23 for us. This is slightly before Central Region started using them, but that was primarily because we were going through, we had a significant number of vacancies within the Fairbanks area at that time. So we were looking to still deliver the same level of service. So we reached out to contractors to help with those services. These contracts are very similar to Central Region in covering priority 3 and 4 roadways, allowing our crews to immediately stay on priority 1s and 2s during event response, and then utilizing the contractors to cover 3 and 4s. As you can see this winter, we've utilized our roadway contract about 4 times in the Fairbanks area, and we've utilized our sidewalks about 5 times this year. I would like to point out that I'll go through the next slide here in a moment, but we do have a significant number of vacancies in our Cordova location down out of Valdez District, and we've spun up a winter maintenance contract down there for some assistance, and we've utilized that contractor once as well. Just for quick reference, I know I have dollars shown out there, and what we have is about a 3-year average expenditure on winter maintenance contracts of about $240,000 a year here in Northern Region, primarily focused in the Fairbanks area. And at this time, we're right around $190,000 to $195,000 spent this winter. So in short, we're kind of on target for that average level of expenditure and response. Of course, that can change as Mother Nature delivers us many different storms. So we'll see how that turns out this year. So, next slide, please. So I wanted to take a moment and illustrate that I spoke about some of our vacancies we've had over the past few years. This is still a challenge for us, but I also do want to highlight a couple locations that we have seen increased recruitment, which is definitely helping our service delivery and overall maintenance throughout the year. I'd specifically like to note our Dalton District right now. Last year at this time, when kind of talking with the legislature, we had 14 positions vacant. And at this same time now, we only have 2 positions vacant. We believe a lot of that's due to the flexible work schedule up there, kind of the 2x2 work schedule of the Dalton District, which does have a little bit of pay incentive to it, too. It also offers us flexibility with being able to move our operators around during their off shift and work in other locations across our region. There's also Fairbanks has diminished as well, but overall you can see over a general downward trend for most of the northern region districts and in some other districts in other regions as well. The one note I did want to say, we are still having difficulty in, I'll say, our Valdez district, and that's primarily in our Cordova area, and that was what I just said, that we are looking at some winter maintenance contracting to overcome some of those vacancies and deliver our services there. And also out in our Western district, we continue to struggle with some of our recruitment efforts out there. Some of those positions, too, are a little more, I don't want to say specialized, but they are a little more focused because they're airport operating positions. There's a little bit more training and experience that needs to go with the duties at the airport with regards to not only operation at the airport, but performing airport firefighting and rescue if necessary as part of their job duties as well. So there's a couple more requirements and training associated with those, so it's not quite as easy to fill. We are working, as we are across the state, to improve our vacancies. Primarily now we'll also offer a program to, I'll say, offer training for CDLs, and the state is covering those costs, so we can send staff to CDL trainings to get their CDL, at which time then they come back and work within the station to basically be trained on how to operate snow removal equipment. So that's been pretty effective for us, too, as part of our looking to overcome our recruitment vacancy issues.
Mr. Sakalaskis, we have two questions. I put myself in the queue first and then my co-chair. But do the equipment operator positions in these locations include the airports? I know you mentioned that for one of these areas, but are the 54 positions in Fairbanks inclusive of the Fairbanks Airport positions?
Great question, Co-Chair Carrick. They do not cover Fairbanks International Airports in these numbers. They do cover other airports, such as some of our smaller rural airports, like I'll say Kotzebue or Dead Horse, Barrow, some of those other larger airports that we are responsible for operation. But they do not include Anchorage or Fairbanks International Airports.
Okay, thank you. We also have a question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Mr. Sakalakis, I had a question about, you made a comment about the Dalton crew. You said they had a flexible work schedule, which I assume means it's different from the other work locations. Can you just briefly describe how that's different so I have a context?
Yes, through the co-chair, Co-Chair Eichheit. I say flexible work schedule, meaning it's slightly different than in some areas. And what I mean by that, it's a 2x2 work schedule. So they work 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. We do have that schedule in other locations. We have some in Fairbanks and actually some out in our Western District as well, trying to incentivize some of those positions. So when I speak to flexible, it is a scheduled 2-on-2 off. But there is flexibility in that they're off for 2 weeks, which is normally a decent amount of duration of time, to where if we have emergency needs or have needs to fill other operating positions for some time to go help with delivering service, say, in response to a storm event, we can assign those operators or ask them to work over, and they may work an additional week in a location. And then still be able to return to get sufficient rest, a week off, to return to their normal work schedule in the Dalton. So it offers us flexibility, I guess I'll say, across the region and actually across the state, as we've worked with other regions as well to utilize staff across the state.
Follow up?
So
kind of related to this, it was context for this follow-up question. That is, you know, of all these positions that are filled, you know, what percent would you say are filled by females, and what are you doing any outreach to increase that representation? Because the context is, I think everyone here would like to have all the vacancies filled. So if you can tap into another group that maybe is not represented on there, is might be useful. So can you just give me some context for that, please?
Yes, through the chair, I believe that was Representative Nelson. Sorry, kind of hard to see from the camera here.
It's Representative Eichheit. It's okay.
Oh, Oh, sorry. I didn't tell who was speaking. Thank you. So I'll say I do not have the percentages of, I'll say, women within the positions filled here. Our actually recruitment process is open to all applicants. So I do say we look for anybody that's interested in working for us and try to fit them within the job classifications, I'll say, they qualify for. And one of the things that we really have opened that up is kind of that CDL program. A lot of people don't maybe come up with the background of driving larger trucks or can afford to come get a CDL. So the department has really opened that door to say we do have grant processes that are federally funded to be able to offer that training. We do cover the full training itself and even pay the individuals to attend and the lodging for it as well. So once you're done with that, in essence, you have a CDL, which qualifies you for our operator positions, and then at which time we train operators on the specific equipment they're operating, just because there are differences in what we operate. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. Next slide, please. So what you see in front of you here is Northern Region this winter has had a fair winter when it comes to snowfall amounts, kind of a regular winter. But what most people have known, we've had some extremely cold weather here in Northern Region this year. So while we have been responding to random snow events, a couple of things that have challenged us is seeing some effects of extreme cold, and we've been performing a lot more water management here this winter. As you can see in the photographs of this slide, this was one creek that basically froze out close to the bottom there. And this is on the Tope cutoff called Little Tope River Bridge. And unfortunately, it ended up overflowing. Did end up getting on the bridge there a little bit, as you can see in the pictures. But crews were able to respond and return, I'll say, the water to a flowing status within its channel again. So at this time, it's performing well. But we are seeing increased overflow areas across the northern region, I'll say, to include multiple locations along the Dalton, at the Elliott, and down some of the Richardson Highway as well. So while we're having a normal winter when it comes to snowfall, the extreme cold is impacting us with regards to some of our overflow issues that are presenting us.
And Mr. Sakalaskis, I did want to pause here and ask, are we struggling in Northern Region and Fairbanks Region with equipment challenges due to the extreme cold? I know that we've had a little bit of that in the city of Fairbanks. It's been literally so cold that the hydraulics on our garbage trucks weren't working for a period of time. Do we have any issues like that with our state equipment fleet?
Thank you, Coach Carrick. I will say, yes, cold weather does impact our fleet as well. We've actually got operational cutoffs, just similar to the city of Fairbanks, in which we do not operate our heavy equipment unless it's an emergency stance, below 30 below. We notice operating below those temperatures really does increase equipment damage and basically impacts our operations pretty heavily. So I will say we still work with our equipment fleet. We do have some downed equipment. But overall, we may have seen a little bit of delayed response to some of our winter events because they were backed by snowfall, followed by cold temperatures in the range of minus 50 below. So some of those restrictions to get cleaned up after winter storm events, we were delayed in some of those responses. And I think that's why you saw some of our targets drop here this year, a little bit down like 72%, as I referenced a little bit earlier. We might have been able to perform a little bit higher level of meet the time targets if we wouldn't have been backed by cold weather directly after our winter storms.
Good to know it's not just a city problem. Thank you. Please continue.
All right. Thank you. Next slide, please. All right. Well, I just got done saying Northern Region hasn't had any, major winter events. We did actually have one major winter event here in January. I don't know if many recall, but it ended up closing the Richardson Highway for a couple days. Just some fun facts in that storm that basically between January 10th and 18th, Valdez experienced about 51 inches of snow and then had an additional 5 inches of rain on top of that. What that caused in the Valdez area, as you can see in your photos here, there was some avalanches that did come down and hit the roadway. And for those that have been around a little while, this is the Damalanche location. So it did impact the roadway again, but not to the severity it did last time. So crews were able to respond to that, basically be able to remove, I'll say, snow from the roadway, perform some avalanche mitigation over the two-day closure, and were able to perform some guardrail repair, which was damaged as a result of that avalanche. Meanwhile, we also had the roadway closed up at Trim's camp between there and, I'll say, kind of Delta. In Isabel Pass there, we had basically a lot of rain, had a lot of warmer temperatures occur. That 5 inches of rain kind of fell up through that area as well, caused extremely slick roads through that area and limited visibility also with regards to blowing snow. So crews worked to restore that roadway back to condition and reopen the roadway. At this time, we still do have ice on the roadway, but we are working to, I'll say, groove that routinely and keep that area sanded pretty heavily. So those are kind of some storm events that will linger with roadway condition and will cause us to use a little bit more, I guess I'll say, materials throughout the winter in response to these, I'll say, Chinook storms or warm weather storms in interior Alaska where it turns to rain and we got frozen pavement temperatures.
And Jason, I might add in here, Andy Mills for the record. On this particular event, there was something of concern. Now, we saw a social media post that had a fabricated image that was kind of recycling some old material and some old themes. And so it's something that our communications team, so I'll just raise this for your awareness. As we communicate more and more with the public, there is, of course, a need for us to be vigilant about misinformation, malinformation, AI-generated content. And so, you know, there are protocols that the communication team is working on to identify those types of images, to authenticate them, and to get messaging out quickly so that those don't sort of run their course before. And so this was one of the interesting things where it was one of the first major ones I saw sharing an image that was not accurate for the event. Jason, back to you.
And right. Mr. Sakalaskis and Mr. Mills, just I want to note for time, we are going to try to wrap this presentation up by 2:10 at the latest. And I know I want to talk about Northern Region all day, but I'm the only one on this committee representing Northern Region specifically. So if we could maybe kind of just touch on the slides a little bit more generally, and then if folks have lots of additional questions, we can note those for another hearing.
For the record, Jason Sakalaskis, absolutely. Ashley Carrick, I can go ahead and do that. So moving on to the next slide there, this is the last Northern Region slide of the deck, and it's kind of one noting one of our last challenge, or some of our other challenges here with regards to kind of the Dalton Highway. Overall, I wanted to touch on, while roadway conditions and weather do give us, give us issues at times, we have seen some incidents and some accidents along the Dalton Highway corridor. One of the things we wanted to point out here real quick is that there's limited commercial support for getting these kind of vehicles unstuck. Normally, when there is a traffic accident, it can block the entire length, entire width of the roadway and actually cause roadway closures. These can be extended periods of time only because of the limited commercial support along the route and the extensive time it takes to get appropriate resources to those locations to respond to those incidents. Also, we do have limited communications along the route, so that can also focus in on some of the challenges associated with that. And with that, that concludes the Northern Region presentation. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Please continue.
And for the record, Andy Mills, that transitions us to the South Coast, where Mr. Zimmerman will take over.
Good afternoon. Marcus Zimmerman, Chief of Maintenance and Operations for South Coast Region, for the record. Can you hear me okay?
We can. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the South Coast Region challenges that we've had this winter and some of our successes that we've had. Our first slide here will kick us off, kind of like Jason had described, with our total number of events this winter, with 69 of them across the region. This region includes Southeast Alaska and the Kodiak-Aleutian District. We had 131 targets, and we had 113% or 113 achievements for an 86.3% achieved targets on our priority level roads 1 through 4. So we still have a little bit of room for improvement, but overall, I think as we move through the slides here and look at some of the challenges for Southeast District, especially, that was a pretty good rating so far this winter. Next slide, please. So last winter, we did do a little bit of contracting for sidewalk maintenance here in Juneau. A small amount was expended on that. This year, we are have expanded our process here in Juneau a little bit farther to some more sidewalks. We've currently spent, as of the 31st of December, $23,000 on sidewalk maintenance contracts. We also have they're not to exceed contracts, and we have one that's a snow haul contract, primarily around moving snow off of areas on sidewalks here in Juneau that you can't just push it to the backside or blow it off. So we've got a couple of sidewalk contracts that work simultaneous together here in Juneau that we're utilizing this year. And so far it's been successful. Without those contracts, it would have been quite challenging to stay up on sidewalk maintenance this winter in Juneau. Next slide, please. Not only Southeast Alaska had some challenges this year, we had a very stormy set of events in December out in Alaska. We had 120 mile an hour winds that caused wave actions on the 1-3 end of our runway there in Alaska, closing the runway for 72 hours. We had to stand up a contract to have some emergency lighting work done out there. Our crews had to clear debris off of the runway, which included pretty large rocks. Also had to regrade the runway safety area and do a little bit of repair to some asphalt at the end of the runway. This happened during one of the busiest times of the year out there in Alaska. It happened at the beginning of the cod fishery season, which is where they bring all the fishermen in and all of the cannery workers. So having the runway closed at that time for that storm was quite significant. The crew did a great job being on top of things as soon as they needed to and could get out there safely to get things back in order for the flights to start coming back into Dutch Harbor there. Next slide, please.
Do we have a question, Representative Stutes?
We do, but I can wait until he's completed his Juno, if you wish, Madam Co-Chair.
Sure, let's go ahead and do that. Please continue. Okay.
Thank you. So Juneau had record-setting snowfalls in December. Several days set snowfall totals, and then the overall month was 80.7 inches of snow for December, which ended up being the second snowiest month ever on record. So quite challenging here in Juneau for the snowfalls. The storm total was 47.7 inches from December 20. It started at like 3 a.m. on December 27th and went into early January.
Damn. And now we'll take that question, Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman, for being here. I can't help but note that Kodiak was left out of this report here. It just kind of dawned on me. And for some crazy reason, we're part of the South Coast, which is hard for me to understand, but we're living with that. What we're having a hard time living with is we've been told for years and years and years, at least my tenure here in the legislature about Sergeant Creek River, which overflows, freezes, and floods homes along the river every year. Every year. And every year we're told that it's going, that DOT is addressing it. And thus far, I haven't seen it. So this is my opportunity to complain, and I'm going to really take advantage of it. The second issue is we have the largest Coast Guard base in existence, as you're well aware of, I'm sure. And there is a whole community on the other side of the Coast Guard base, but it seems when they clear the roads, they go as far as the Coast Guard base. And every single year since I've been here, when there is a weather event, I'm getting calls because the people that live in Bell's Flats can't get to town and they can't get to the Coast Guard base. And so it really alarms me to see a community that's been divided the way Kodiak has.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, as far as the Russian River, Sergeant Creek goes, I do know that there is a bridge project out in that area. I don't have details on project status. We could take a look and get you more information on that. I personally wasn't aware that there was issues up the stream there where it was flooding out homes and causing icing and things like that on the roads. We can definitely look into that and get more information and give you a project status update for Sergeant Creek and Russian River area.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. I would be very grateful to if you would do that. It would give me an opportunity to let these people know that in fact they are that you are cognizant of it, because it is truly a critical issue where at some point cars can't even cross there because the water has flooded the bridge so significantly. And it'd be nice when they clear the river, the roads, if they'd go at least as far as Marine Hill. Appreciate that.
And if, through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, to address your second question or comment, I believe Marine Hill is the one that is beyond Bell's Flats, if that's correct. I do know that the district superintendent, Sharon Clark, has instructed the crew there to clear to the top of that hill, the one going southwest past Bell's Flats, because we have heard that same concern. That going to the Coast Guard base, you know, does something for some folks, but does not take into account the folks that live in Bell's Flats. So hopefully you'll see better service as we continue through the winter and if we have more storms this winter, that you'll see better service out there.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. I really appreciate that. I have talked to Sharon several times, and she's been, I know that you guys are overwhelmed and understaffed, and she's been very, very willing to try and help out in whatever we can. So I would appreciate any additional efforts going in that direction. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. I'm looking to see if we have any additional questions. Representative McCabe, did you have a question?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay.
I used to live in Bell's Flats. I was a Flats rat.
And Mr. Zimmerman, I think it would be great for the committee to see the status report on that Sergeant River Bridge that was mentioned. I think that'd be good for the committee to have. Please continue. I think we were on slide 29.
Thank you. Skagway and Haines also, during that same snow event, received record-setting snowfalls. We had definitely severe weather conditions up on the Klondike Highway, which is one of our entrances into Canada and into the road system that connects the lower 48 and Alaska. The Klondike Highway had 287 hours of road closure already this winter, starting back in November of 2025. That's pretty significant. Last year, we only had 100 and I'm not exactly sure, but it was not near that. It was 100 and some hours of road time closure on the Klondike Highway. So very significant already this year for closures due to avalanche, blizzard conditions, drifting, things like that. We also had 43 hours of closure on the Haines Highway due to avalanches as well, as opposed to last year where there were no closures due to avalanche on Haines Highway. So very significant weather event. We did authorize emergency contracts for additional resources to help clear snow. We brought folks in from Ketchikan, our maintenance folks from our Ketchikan station to help up in Haines. We also asked Northern Region for support as well with staffing. They sent an operator to Skagway. They also sent an operator to Haines and an operator to Juneau, along with a snowblower resource that we needed here in Southeast that we didn't have. They brought it down from Fairbanks and got it onto the ferry for us, and that same night ended up getting snowed in Haines and stuck around and helped us plow for a couple of days because they couldn't get out of Haines. So luckily we were able to get the resources we needed for Juneau on the ferry and down here, and then Northern Region supported us even more there by staying around a couple of days plowing.
Mr. Zimmerman, actually on this slide, you know, we heard stories with some of the Anchorage snowfalls in the last few years and with these weather events now on South Coast too, the equipment sharing with Northern Region, and it just always brings up this question to me of, and I guess this question for Mr. Mills, how are we doing on having equipment in Central and South Coast regions? Because, you know, one of these times we're going to have this level of storm event in Northern Region and South Coast, and I don't want either area to be underserved with our equipment. But it seems like that equipment sharing is great. That's a great success story. But what do we need more of on South Coast to have to prevent that epic travel for some of that equipment?
Yeah, I'll take one initial stab. Andy Mills, for the record. So a previous regional director did say you don't build your church for Easter Sunday, right? So there's a limiting factor as to, you know, how much you resource up to, considering, is it a 100-year event? Is it a 500-year event? And I think that's the reason that you've seen the approach on contracting supplemental assistance when we need to scale up. But as for equipment, we're very fortunate to also have Brad Bilsma on the phone from our state equipment fleet. And I'll let Marcus call out to anyone else who would like to specifically talk about how they share and capacity.
For the record, Marcus Zimmerman, thank you for the question, Co-Chair Carrick. Yes, it was great that Northern Region was able to help share the snowblower that was needed here in Juneau. At the time, they didn't need it as part of their pooled equipment up there in Fairbanks. You know, we do have resources in Juneau. At the time, we had broke down equipment and things like that. So that's where the request came for Northern Region and to see if they did have anything available to share with us down here. So I'm happy that they were able to. And I guess if Brad has anything additional to add, as this is a fleet question as well.
And I think right before you answer, Mr. Bilsma, I just want to maybe clarify, are there areas of need in Central or South Coast region where we just don't have a piece of equipment that we really need for some of these extreme weather events, or is it more we share from Northern Region when Northern Region can spare it and there's these major weather events? So I guess that's more my question.
For the record, Brad Bilsma, DOT Equipment Fleet Manager. Can you hear me okay?
We can, yes.
Okay. I think my answer, or the answer, would be to kind of echo what both Andy Mills and Marcus have said. Andy's reference to not building your church for Easter Sunday is certainly a part of it. We don't have the fleet or the manpower or the resource or other resources to respond to a what you might call an apocalyptic statewide storm event. But we do have resources to share, and the three regions certainly have done a very good job of sharing both personnel resources and fleet resources to do that. And we help with that. We maintain, we call it a daily rental pool or a pool of vehicles and equipment that is not necessarily assigned to the specific region or even to DOT for that matter. So we're able to help in that way. And to kind of answer your question, there is always a need for more equipment, maybe not specifically in any one particular region. And we're accomplishing that just by sharing and moving resources. Last year, in kind of converse to what we're talking about, at the end of the winter last year, last winter, there was a major snow event and landslide event that ended up with closing the Parks Highway. And we surged resources from Central Region to help out in the northern region. So we attack it in that way. And then, as Marcus mentioned, the contracting community, all three regions have very good relationships with contractors and private equipment operators to assist.
Thank you, Mr. Bilesma. That's extremely helpful. And just to reiterate, they're sharing across the regions, so we have what we need in each region when we have these kind of more extraordinary events and there's availability. We do some of that sharing. That I'm trying to just summarize. I think that's what I'm hearing.
Co-Chair Carrick, that's correct.
Okay. Awesome.
And for the record, Andy Mills, for one more thing, Co-Chair Carrick, it's last year there was, of course, a reduction in M&O from a UGF standpoint, but there was also, and Director Pannone or, again, Brad could probably fill in more, but we are running short on time, was the extension of time on vehicles. It's a strategy that the department had employed over the last decade or so, where you extend the life of an existing asset to try and get more out of it. But that, and Brad can speak to this much more, but bringing it to a simple sort of summary would be the longer, of course, you use an asset, the more downtime it can have, the more expensive it is to keep running. So maybe one note to give is rather than new equipment, we do also want to focus on the equipment with a serviceable life and keep it up and running. So extending the life does have its own detrimental impact as opposed to just simply adding more equipment into the mix with the old fleet.
Great. Thank you for that, Mr. Mills. I apologize for thank you to the committee for the latitude on that series of questions. We have about five or six slides left. I'm just going to ask Mr. Zimmerman to kind of, again, summarize them fairly quickly. And if we do have a lot of questions, we'll be happy to bring this subject up again later. Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you. For the record, Marcus Zimmerman, South Coast Region Maintenance and Operations Chief. So this next slide, the governor issued a state disaster declaration on January 6th, 2026 that covered the December storm events here in Southeast Alaska. The State Emergency Operations Center asked that the State Public Facilities Division supply some personnel to come down and help the city and borough of Juneau clearing some of their critical roofs on their infrastructure. So the state supported there. We also supported here in Juneau with our avalanche specialists helping make decisions with the city and borough avalanche specialists. We also supplied some LIDAR flights, which is light detecting and ranging. It's a way to measure 3D model the snowpack. So we were able to help in that capacity. We also use drones that the state DOT has to help look at different snowpacks up on the mountains here around Juneau. We did also for the South Coast Avalanche specialist, we were able to detect the first avalanches using infrasound down on Thane Road here in Juneau, which was a pretty cool thing. The day that he told me about that, he was super excited. He's been working on a research project for the last 2 years, and this last storm cycle, he was able to actually see or hear avalanche activity. And our next slide will show that what that looks like. So, again, Juneau did get additional staffing resources, thanks to Northern Region, additional equipment here. Thane Road, up to this point of the slideshow, was closed for 93 hours due to avalanche activity. And this lower, the photo on here shows the infrasound and avalanche detection. So we don't have to actually be seeing the mountain sliding. Each of these little dots is an indication of movement on the mountain. The road was closed at this time, so this does show that there was activity there while we had the road closed. We can see this in the middle of the night. We can see this in low visibility conditions. So some pretty cool new technology that has got great potential for our avalanche detection systems here in Alaska. And that's my last slide.
Great. Thank you. Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just have a quick comment. There obviously, due to the weather situation, was a lot of additional expenses this year shared between the different areas. My only request would be, when we have our subcommittee meetings, don't sit and tell us we're fine, this is all the money we need, when we know that you need an increase. Step up to the plate and let us know that if you need an increase in a certain area because of these incidences, we're not mind readers. We need you to let us know that information. And in the past couple of years, it's always been, we're fine, we're fine, we're fine, and then we end up with a big hole in our budget. So that's my request to you. Thank you.
I think I'm a mind reader. I can tell that Representative Carrick wants more equipment for Fairbanks. It's pretty easy.
I just want all the other regions to stop borrowing our equipment. I'm kidding. I really appreciate the comments on sharing equipment, and I love that we have a working relationship across regions and can do that. But I concur with Representative Stutes that just because the department says there's a need doesn't mean it's going to get funded right away, but it's good to know in advance some of the needs that you have as well as current needs, especially based off of some of these very significant winter maintenance events we just saw within this last year and the sort of expectation that we may see more significant events. Thank you again, Mr. Zimmerman. We have about 10 slides left. I'm going to ask that we just, if there's things you want to really make sure we note, we can do that, but that we go through them really quickly here. And if committee members have a very strong interest in any of these topics we've discussed, we can do a separate time for that later. Oh, Representative Mina.
Oh.
No question. Okay.
So, for the record, Andy Mills, I don't know that there's a slide that, in particular, that we, again, Director Langley, who can talk as fast as I can, if not faster, like if you're from the East Coast, she could probably cover hers fairly quick, but I do think that would take at least 5 or 10 more minutes. The state equipment fleet might be worth just, I'm sure Brad can cover that. So I would suggest maybe just the state equipment fleet slides real fast. We can always bring some of the innovation pieces into a future conversation.
I think that would be great. And we, just for the committee members' information, the co-chairs do plan to have a whole hearing on the state equipment fleet at some point. So that's going to come up for the committee as well. Should we go to Ms. Langley then? All right. Ms. Langley, feel free to help us breeze through these last few slides.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. For the record, Christine Langley, Data Modernization and Innovation Director with the Department of Transportation. So this first slide is a dashboard which you can access with the QR code on the right. As Mr. Zimmerman mentioned, and he listed many large numbers when you look at it from a statewide impact, 56 times avalanches impacted the roadway for a total closure of 729 hours in 2025. We are in many other areas to proactively mitigate avalanches as opposed to be reactive. Andy, next slide, please. We have been working on three new methods that we have put up, and I apologize for the dates that you see on the slide. This one was done in January of 2026, and so it's just recently been installed. This is a radar system. This system requires essentially line of sight in order to detect an avalanche, so it's very good in locations where we know exactly where the chute is. We have a very high interest in one or two locations, and this one was installed just the other day on the mile 21 of the Seward Highway there, so between Anchorage and Girdwood. Ultimately, this reports automatically. We intend to tie this into 511 and ultimately get to a place where we're closing gates on the road in order to proactively assist the traveling public. The next one is the radar system. This is the one that, The next one is infrasound. This is the one that we had been using for research, and we were excited to see it come to fruition the other day in South Coast, and we've now installed one of those in on the Seward Highway as well. This one is good because it does not require line of sight. We can deploy it in an area where we can listen, so we can get beyond that first ridge and maybe into that second, and this too will provide automated notification. The third one, next slide, is just entertaining to say. So this is genuinely called the boom whoosh, and the boom whoosh is currently down in Thompson Pass. We are training staff on it and probably laughing at the name a little bit. The benefit of this is it does not require ammunition, so this deploys, I believe some of my staff has referred to it as a very large potato gun, and so this uses propane to create you could think of it as a bolus of air that projects out and knocks the avalanche down. It is much safer for the public. It can recharge in 20 seconds and can shoot up to 30 times. This means that our ability to proactively close the road, clear the road, mitigate the avalanche, clear the road, and get the road back open will be greatly increased over where we are today with the howitzers. These three new tools are all part of our ongoing multi-pronged approach. So we know that to proactively handle avalanches that occur in clear sky conditions, times when you cannot fly, we need this holistic approach to how we're handling it. And so we're excited to bring these three new tools online. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Langley. That was great. I think let's go ahead and save these last slides on the state equipment fleet until we are able to have a more full discussion on that and go ahead and set them aside. Thank you, Mr. Mills, and all of our operations managers in the different regions for presenting to us today. We are going to now transition to at least the beginning of a discussion about advanced construction for committee members' information. I think it's our intention to have a pretty full discussion on advanced construction as much as the committee would like. So whatever we don't get to today, we'll probably bring back up at a future hearing. But would like to go ahead and transition now to our advanced construction conversation. We'll just take a very brief at ease. House Transportation Committee is back on the record. Welcome to Mr. Mills and Mr. Pannone. And if all three of you would please introduce yourselves for the record, and we can go ahead and begin Mr. Moser, thank you. If you could go ahead and begin our presentation on advanced construction.
For the record, Don Pannone, Director of Program Management and Administration at the Alaska Department of Transportation. So today's presentation, we're going to explore and try to demystify and answer any questions that the committee has on advanced construction, a financing tool that the department uses to manage the throughput of construction projects for surface transportation and through the Federal Highway Administration. Moving to slide two, what is advanced construction? It is a tool that is explicitly authorized under 23 U.S.C. Section 115 with guidelines established in the Code of Federal Regulations that allows us to begin a project without committing federal funds and using state funds for those expenditures until a point at which we decide to formally obligate and permanently obligate federal funds to that project. So federal reimbursement occurs later when we have the authority, when we have room in our budget, or when we decide to convert what is a advanced construction project to a formally obligated federally funded project. And it does commit future federal funds, and these funds are outlined in our state transportation improvement plan. So why is it an important tool for delivery? One of the things it allows us to do is increase our project throughput in a given construction year when transportation needs exceed the amount of federal funding that we have on an annual basis. So we can advance additional projects if they're ready to go beyond just the federal funds we have available. It can also be used during a short construction season where we have high mobilization costs or other cost drivers where project bids come in high, and yet we want to make sure that we proceed on all the projects that we had planned to proceed on. It also enables obligations of specific fund types that are very hard to use. So DOT has over 30 fund types that we get from the Federal Highway Administration. Some of those have very specific uses. And as we try to make sure we use all those every year, it's a lot like a game of Tetris. And so we may have a unique bridge project or a carbon reduction project that uses those specific funds, and maybe it can use up 5 years of those funds. So we will use up 1 year and then AC the rest so that in subsequent years we can find a place to make sure we're capturing hard to use fund types. So it's a strategic tool as well to make sure we're maximizing all the federal funds that we receive.
We have a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So when you utilize these AC funds, do they have to be utilized on a project that would be federally approved?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, yes, we are required to have that program, that project be in our STIP. So it's required to be in the STIP, and we will, on subsequent slides, explain that it's held to all the same standards as any other federally funded project.
Follow up?
I think I'll hold it until I hear the rest of it. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do we have any additional questions? Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, how does that reimbursement process work? So specifically the AC conversion, and what are those federal requirements in order for us to get reimbursed?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, when we submit to the Federal Highway Administration that we want to advance a project using advanced construction, we will also indicate what fund source in the future we think we're going to use when it comes time to get reimbursement. That project then has to go through several months before it may occur any expenditures. We may authorize that project in winter, and it's not going to have expenditures till summer. So we may convert to federal obligations before there's any expenditures, or we may carry expenditures on the advanced construction up into when the project's complete. And at that point, we submit to the federal government a request to use any of our eligible fund sources, and if there are expenditures, we get reimbursed for that. And that's the conversion process.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't see any additional questions at this time, so please continue.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. This slide is to provide just a little bit of context about how we phase projects. Federal Highway Administration and the Alaska DOT phases the projects into discrete phases and ties funding to these discrete phases. Phase two being what we generally refer to as design. Phase three is all right-of-way acquisition costs or any right-of-way transactions. Phase four is often the point at which we contract out for the actual construction of a project. Phase seven is any utilities coordination and relocation. When we AC or obligate federal funds, we have to do that for a particular phase. We have to know the cost of a particular phase, and each obligation or AC authorization is tied to a discrete phase. And when do we typically use advanced construction? We typically use it when we're ready to go to construction and either we haven't received all of our funds for a given federal fiscal year, or when we're ready to go to construction on a project. That's typically when we use it for phase four. We do use advanced construction for other phases, but that's less common. And then the last point is we are able to use the AC to, again, ensure that across our STIP, we're using the hard-to-use fund sources. So the PROTECT funds, carbon reduction funds, those we can move funds around based on when we have projects available.
We have a couple of questions here, Mr. Pinone, and I just kind of put myself in the queue. First of all, when we look back at slide two, it says, why is AC an important tool in Alaska? And I see basically these four items all referring to kind of like last minute or short-term changes that would allow us to essentially complete those projects or make sure that a project gets off the ground. But on slide three, we say, you know, where it's most commonly applied and that it allows DOT to advance the construct or pre-construction phases without waiting for obligation authority and converting later. It seems as though, however, we've used that allowed authority a lot more visibly in the recent past than the commonly applied authority. I'm sure that's not the case. I'm sure it's just that we only hear as much about the sort of situations where we've used AC for this pre-construction authority. But how typical is it in sort of a 10 or 15 year time scale versus the recent past to kind of utilize AC under this allowed authority for larger new projects in Alaska?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair Carrick. So I think we're talking about two different uses of advanced construction. And there's the use within the year where we would likely have a project proceed under advanced construction and allow us to determine, to give us flexibility on which funds we're going to use to the end of the year or maybe the following year. And then there's the amount of advanced construction that we program in the STIP to increase the total number of projects that we plan on delivering. That's how we've used it, and I think that's the lens in which you may have seen or heard more about how we're using advanced construction. We do have a slide showing the historical context for the past over 20 years. We will talk about that there. And then I'd like to have Adam Mosier, our Fed Aid Section Chief, also maybe elaborate a little more.
Yes, hello. For the record, Adam Mosier, Program Management Chief, DOTNPF, and through the chair. One example of within a fiscal year using AC is currently, of course, at the federal level, we do not have a full year appropriations bill for transportation. Our obligation authority limitation will sometimes be limited. So if there's a large design project or otherwise that comes to us and it has to use that limitation authority, because Congress does not provide all of that to the states until a full year federal appropriations bill has been passed, That is when we would often use AC within a given fiscal year to move that design phase forward or other increases on a project, with the expectation that we would convert that within the same fiscal year. So we can keep projects on schedule, even though we may have constraints related to that obligation authority coming from the federal government.
I have follow-ups, but I think I'm going to leave it there for right now because I know we have a lot more in the presentation. But what you just said, I believe, Mr. Mosier, is really important. You know, it helps us keep currently operating projects going, and that's what I've seen, you know, thus far or historically, but it's not necessarily what we're hearing about in the very short term recent use of AC. So I want to make a note that I do have additional questions here, but we can move on to Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm a little bit confused, and so let me ask this question. If we have federal funding that has been awarded but not received, we don't have it, and so this project's moving forward, you can use your AC until you receive that money. If the federal funds have been awarded for this project, can you utilize the anticipation of those funds for this project over here?
For the record, Don Pannone, through the chair, Representative Stutes, when DOT receives our apportionment, which is the calculated amount that Alaska is entitled to federal funds, we then get, as Mr. Mosier said, buckets of authority and limitation. Those aren't tied to any specific project until we obligate a project with authority to proceed. So that tying of funds to projects happens first in the STIP as the plan, and then when they're ready to proceed. It's when we have yet to receive the limitation from the federal government that we might proceed under advanced construction. There are times when a project in the STIP in a given year may have delays for due to right-of-way or utility issues, and we would then use the funds for another project that may be ready to advance and then shift the funding between two different years, as we're allowed to do within the STIP.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick follow-up. But once you've obligated the funds for, say, a right-of-way, and it's not quite ready, so you're going to use those funds, the next year you're obligated to complete that job with funds, wherever they come from. I mean, if you've used them over here because the project's not shovel-ready, so to speak, are you still obligated to complete that job when it becomes shovel-ready, whether it's later that or the next year?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, once we do obligate funds on any particular phase of a project, we are obligated to complete that phase, and the federal government is obligated to reimburse us as long as we're compliant. And I can let our program chief, Mr. Mosier, talk about the amount of time we have to complete after a obligation.
Thank you.
Yes, for the record, Adam Mosier, through the chair to Representative Stutes. Once funds are obligated, they are available for a project until that project is completed and or closed. And we do have ways that we can, if for some reason unforeseen, a project has not moved to completion, to request federal participation still in that project. But generally, we strive to complete all the projects that we do start and obligate those funds on. And just point of clarification, when one of the advantages of ACing a project, sometimes there will be specific grant funding that may be specific to a project, but because of recently we've seen at the federal level holdups in getting that money for grants to the state to go to those projects, we can still use advanced construction to get that project started And then when we do finally receive those specific discretionary grant funding that is tied to a specific project, then we can convert and obligate that grant funding when it comes in, because AC is not an obligation of federal funds. But we have all of the other federal approvals that are required to move that project forward under federal participation.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through to the Co-Chair. So on this slide, the very last bullet, you know, as I see that bullet, that is an advantage of using the AC approach. But I don't see any downsides listed. What are the downsides or impacts, negative impacts of using AC approach? And I assume there's some. So just would like clarification on that, please.
So for the record, Andy Mills, legislative liaison at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. As a downside to suggest, certainly I think when we're talking to policymakers, they look at the future repayment of that as a potential downside. But again, if the project is ready to advance, pay now, pay later. If it's ready to go now, you're advancing that. And I think, again, for our contracting community, that was a large part of the conversation last year, was get projects on the street, get that infrastructure accomplished. And so you've seen us leveraging this tool to accomplish just that, which we heard from policymakers, which was to meet the demand of our contracting community to get work on the street and spend the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act dollars that we have available to us. Again, I see that as a potential downside, but again, if it's ready to advance, I don't know if I'd call it a downside, but I think it's been perceived by some as. Thank you.
I have a follow-up to Co-Chair Eichheit's question. At the previous hearing we had on the match dollars that the legislature needs to appropriate, I had asked the question of, is there any pushback or risk to the contractors for having a project be AC versus already obtained federal funds? And the answer was no, there's no difference to the contracting community. But I just want to note that it does seem like a disadvantage. And I think what you just said, Mr. Mills, is accurate. If you're a contractor, you want to know that if possible, those federal funds are secured and in the bank, and DOT is paying you with funds it's already got to obligate, as opposed to AC funds. To me, that if I was a contractor, I would probably prefer that. So it seems like just a little bit of a contradiction from what we've heard before. And I know that there's a lot of potential for using AC funds to fill gaps for our early construction season this year. So I guess I just wanted to note that, and if you had any comment.
For the record, Don Pannone. So when we're talking about paying back the AC, we're talking about using our federal dollars to pay back the state or reimburse the state. AC is not visible. It's transparent to the contractor. So when we have a contract proceed under advanced construction, we have the cash management and encumber and obligate the funds. So from the contractor's perspective, there's no difference or risk or liability for them. What it does mean is that later at some point, when we're programming future years of funds, we have to consider whether we keep carrying this balance indefinitely, or perhaps we have a low year where there's a major construction, statewide construction project, or we have a reduction in match, and we would then instead use those federal dollars to pay down our AC balance. But in every individual contract, there's no difference to the contractor.
And for the record, Andy Mills, I try to do my best to maybe put it in terms that maybe make more sense to the average person. For someone maybe listening on this, it might be akin in my mind to someone who has budgeted in their personal finances for a new vehicle because their current vehicle needs to be replaced. And so they're getting a zero APR loan with a few months where they don't have to pay. So you're paying zero interest, you're using funds you're planning to spend, but you're basically getting it, and then you will start the payments that you had already planned on. And so in this case, you're meeting the need of that moment with a mechanism that allows you to. So again, it's transparent to the contracting community, in this case, the individual who needs transit because their current vehicle doesn't work. So if that assists in an analogy to explain, it's a timing piece, and that's really the tool that we have, is the timing piece when something is ready.
As a follow-up, though, do we potentially lose some confidence from our contracting community if we use AC over a long period of time as opposed to already obtained federal funds? Because it's kind of like if I pay a contractor to come work on my roof, on my house, if I give them cash in hand, it's no different than using a credit card. But if I'm using a credit card, you know, for five or six 20 grand purchases for my roof, at some point the contractor might sort of raise their eyebrows like, are you sure you can pay that credit card balance off? And I guess maybe it's a subtle nuance, maybe it doesn't make a big difference to the contracting community, but you know, I've received a little bit of feedback to the contrary that it does inspire a little more confidence when we know we have those federal funds as opposed to AC. And I'm sorry, Representative McCabe's been in the queue for a while, so that's my last bit, and then I would like to go to Rep. McCabe. Let's just go to Representative McCabe. And
thanks, and through the chair. So, and I don't know who it's for, probably Mr. Pannone. So there is a bill working through another committee here that has a automatic penalty for payment from the state to a contractor that's delayed more than a certain number of days. This sounds complicated to a certain extent. I mean, I know you have a great handle on it, but how often does this cause a delay, the federal government repayment cause a delay that then causes you to have to delay paying a contractor? Is that a thing? And if so, do we plan for that? Are you going to have like a slush fund for these automatic penalties?
For the record, Don Pannone, through the co-chair, Representative McCabe. That's an excellent question. It does not create a problem for payments to the contractor. When we enter into a contract with a contractor, we have the same payment requirements, whether it's under AC or a federal obligation, and we encumber the funds within the accounting system to be able to meet our payment deadlines regardless. So the function of AC and the mechanism of AC has no interaction with how DOT pays its bills.
That's good. Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Representative Mina, sorry, I'm getting lost in my queue today, so if you have a question, please get my attention.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, I want to make sure I'm getting this straight. Is there a scenario where if you are using AC, you don't receive federal obligation? Does that happen?
Through the co-chair, Representative Mina, that has not happened in the two-decade history and longer that we've had advanced construction.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up?
Through the co-chair, just does it happen in other states? Because I'm just trying to think, you know, if we have this ability to AC projects, what's stopping the state from just ACing everything?
Through the co-chair, Representative Mina, I'll let Mr. Moser speak to if that's ever happened in another state or if he's aware of that ever happening. But our limiting factors, we do have a slide on that. We can only AC up to our match. So we have to have match on hand when we enter into AC. And so that goes into our match, our annual match request. The limits are also within the STIP. These projects have to be programmed within the STIP. And then we also have to have legislative authority for the project itself at the time as well. So those are the constraints. And I'll let Mr. Moser speak to General AC.
Yes, for the record, Adam Moser, through the chair, Representative Mina. And just an add-on on what constrains the use of just ACing everything. From the federal side, The transportation funds that come to us every fiscal year, they are good for 3 years after the year that they arrive. So if you were to just AC everything, you would not actually be obligating those funds, and they would lapse. You would lose those federal funds. So it is a mechanism. You want to obligate those funds. You want to use the obligation limitation authority that you have. That's what qualifies a state to apply for additional limitation during that August redistribution period that you've heard about. So there's a big strategy there in obligating funds when it's appropriate to obligate, and then having AC as an option when it's not appropriate to obligate, or there may be better options in the future when you can obligate funding in the future on that project. And then as to risks with whether the federal government would ever not convert at the time that you want to obligate the funds or convert your AC on the project, I'm unaware of that having ever happened at another state level. I think the underlying analysis there would be if in the time that you received your federal authority to proceed on that project and the time that you went to convert the funding on it to obligate the funds, there would have been something that happened that made the project ineligible for federal funding. But at that point, you would be also be asked to repay any previously obligated federal funds on the project. So I don't think it's a risk of AC per se. It's more of something happened in that period of time that made the entire portion of that project not eligible for federal participation.
Thank you. That makes sense.
Representative St. Clair.
Through the chair, quick question. It's kind of like the elephant in the room for me because AC was brought up pertaining to match federal funds. Mm-hmm. Can AC be used as match for the federal, I don't know if it's IJA or what, the $70 million we have to pony up?
Through the co-chair, Representative St. Clair, it's a great question. Unfortunately, no is the answer to that. We can only AC the federal portion. We're required to have the match encumbered at the time we use AC.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, I had heard that that AC was a possibility, and after reading your slides, I didn't think so, but that was the big question that I had. Thank you.
Yeah. Great question. Co-chair Eichheit?
Yeah, thank you, co-chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, since we brought up repayment or payment to contractors, And for context, you know, I don't understand your timelines for paying contractors for work they do. So, and the context is totally different program, but we know that, you know, the state of Alaska has been fined by the federal government for not meeting its timely processing of, say, like SNAP applications. So what is the typical payment timeline for contractors using these AC funds? How is the state doing? And is there any fines that the federal government can levy because you don't make timely payments?
Through the co-chair, co-chair Eichheit, excellent question. So we do track timely contractor payments as one of our program metrics. I don't have those with me today, but Director Christine Langley, I can work with her to provide those as a metric. Late payments are subject to interest, and when we have late payments, contractors can request interest payments on top of the reimbursement that they are entitled to. There are also non-financial implications that also drive DOT to make timely payments, and that is caring for our contractors. They have to make their payroll, and we're working with contractors on multiple jobs. We absolutely are committed to making sure that our contractors are paid what they're owed timely, just as a matter of principle as well.
Follow up? Yeah, I would appreciate that those metrics, and I would really like to see what the total interest that goes to contractors because of late payments, you know, because you mentioned that, and that gives me a sense of how much we are paying in additional funds for late payments. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative St. Clair?
Through the co-chair. Rep. Eichheit, in reference to that legislation that you were talking about, that for interest on late payments for grants, et cetera, is actually modeled after one that is done for DOT and contractors. So they're already doing it. They just took the language, added municipality, tribal, nonprofits, et cetera. So it's modeled after legislation or statute already.
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair, I appreciate that. I just would like to see those metrics, and as I said, but thank you for that clarification.
And just for the record, the piece of legislation that's been brought up is House Bill 133 from Rebecca Hemshute, Representative Hemshute. Sorry. I'm seeing we only have about 10 minutes left, so I'd love to just continue this conversation where we're at. Get through whatever slides we can. Just want to note that we do have a full calendar on Thursday, but we will bring back up this presentation at a future date as soon as we can. And I really appreciate the discussion today. Feel free to continue.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Dom Pannone. I think we're moving to slide 4. And slide 4 just provides citations and technical references as to where this tool resides in law and where it resides in the Code of Federal Regulations and the requirements that it be included in our State Transportation Improvement Plan and that it is subject to all other requirements that federal funds and federal funded projects would be subject to. Also here at the bottom is 49 U.S.C. 5304. Title 49 is where statutes for the U.S. federal DOT live and for our planning documents. And this is the portion that outlines that we can essentially move projects and funding around within the four-year period of the STIP so that if a project is delayed, we can bring another project forward and swap them back or advance construct a project if we need to and then use federal funds in the following year. Moving to slide 5, this speaks to a question that was raised earlier as to what is our limitation in implementing AC. And the first, from the federal perspective, the caps on the AC balances from the federal highway side were removed in 1995. There was an allowance to go up to a year beyond what your funding was. So your funding on an annual basis plus 1 year. And that was removed several decades ago. The state appropriation and match requirements, as well as the STIP, we have to have legislative authority when we proceed with our contracts, and we have to have the match secured when we proceed with a project under advanced construction. And those calculations are provided every year to the legislature in our annual match request. Moving to slide 6. So this, I think, is a great slide that illustrates how we've used AC over time and also how much the program has grown. When we look at today's balances in AC, and they may appear to be high numbers, but relatively speaking, the program itself has gotten much higher than it was, say, back in 2004. So this slide shows in the blue bars how much the State Department of Transportation received on an annual basis, and then the red line shows what our AC balance was as a percentage of how much we were receiving on an annual basis. So you can see in 2006, we were at 200%. We were quite overextended from our annual apportionments. And then we've brought it back down. And right now, we're trying to target about 1 year of apportionments out and keep it within that range.
Representative Mina?
Through the co-chair, just a quick question. What was going on in 2006?
Through the co-chair, Representative Mina, this is my 8th session with the department, and so I can't speak to that. Maybe Mr. Mills can.
For the record, Andy Mills, no, I don't have an answer on that. I was somewhere completely different, but we will put that down as something to get back to you. On this slide, though, I would love to put a little additional context, because your initial conversation did talk about valid concerns about managing an AC balance and utilization of that tool. And it's important, I think, contextually to make sure we also add, it's been some time since there was a geobond package. The capital budget has been lean. And so from a, I think maybe because a contractor's not at the table, and they can speak for themselves in time, I do want to suggest that we keep in mind the totality of infrastructure funding that's out there. And that, again, in response to our contracting community saying there's not enough work for the workforce we anticipated with this infrastructure bill and everything out there, that there are other factors at play with that. And so, again, trying to manage this, and you can see historically the levels are well within norm comparative to the relative scale. It's important for us to keep that context in mind.
Co-Chair Eichheit?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. My question goes to the previous slide. Just something I heard, I just want to clarify. You know where it says state appropriations and match requirements on the bottom third? It said, you know, the state of Alaska must have legislative appropriation authority to cover this. And I kept thinking, okay, where is that in the budget? And I thought I heard somebody say it's in the annual match request to the legislature. Did I hear that correctly?
For the record, Don Pannone, through the co-chair to the co-chair, Eichheit, yes, the match is, we have a single match appropriation with three allocations in the capital budget, and there is a specific FedAid highway allocation, and that is where our match calculation for the on an annual basis is calculated.
Follow up. So just to clarify, the $60-odd million for federal match that was vetoed, could that affect this amount at all? I mean, that's what I'm trying to compute. I heard match. I know that about $62 million was vetoed in match. So did that impact this match for AC?
Through the co-chair to co-chair Eichheit, yes. I think it's fair to say that on our list of project sequences that we were planning to deliver new projects, some of those projects were AC'd, and some of the match would be allocated for those projects to get them put out on the street. Correct.
Thank you.
I also have a question, I guess, on this slide. The STIP projects currently that, I guess, not including the rolling STIP that we now have, but STIP projects can apply for between 1 and 4 years, current and 4 years away. And so my question is, if a project gets into the STIP and it doesn't begin its construction phase until that fourth year, so we're projecting out quite a ways, can the department then utilize funds for that project in the current year to AC another project? Is that something that we can do?
You could always ask to reframe the question. To the co-chair, I may not answer this. I may not fully understood it, but we have to show AC usage in our STIP. And so we're limited to that much AC usage. If we displace a funding source anywhere within the 4 years of our STIP, we either need to make an amendment to the STIP or swap where we had the funds in another project. And maybe I can speak more specific.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to figure out the liquidity of your ability to use AC for projects. So if the limitation on AC has to be in the STIP and have to have the ability to reimburse that with federal funds that we receive, that seems like pretty open-ended for the department. And so I'm just trying to figure out if you have Project A in the STIP that begins in 2026 construction season, and you have Project B in the STIP that begins not until the 2030 construction season, can you take funds that we have said we will eventually need and use in 2030 and just bring them back to 2026 after that STIP is completed? So essentially, like, take from those projects that are that we've put in our STIP that are potentially going to happen in 2, 3, 4 years to fund today's projects. Can Project B be used to fund Project A, I guess, is the question. And if we need to take it offline at some point, we can too.
Co-Chair Carrick, generally speaking, no, we can't use funding from another project to fund another project. We have to be fiscally constrained within the STIP. But we'd be happy to go over specific scenarios further.
So I think this is probably as good a point as any to just put a pause on the conversation here. And thank you for trying to wrap your mind around that question. We will pick up the advanced construction discussion in a future week. We won't be able to get to it this week, but there are a lot of questions here, and so I think it'll be good to bring everybody back. And thank you, Mr. Moser, for being here today, and Mr. Pannone, and Mr. Mills, as always. So our next House Transportation Committee meeting will be this Thursday, February 5th at 1:30 here in room 124. As a reminder, we do have the House Transportation Finance Subcommittee beforehand, and we'll have a delayed start at 1:30. So that subcommittee runs from 12:30 to 1:30. We will be having just an overview presentation on the functions of the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board, and then we will have DOT and Alaska Marine Highway System folks to talk about current projects, including Cascade Point. Thank you to the members of the committee, and we are adjourned at 2:59 p.m.